This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Greetings and welcome to New Books in History. I am your host, Monica Black, and today I have the great pleasure to speak with Luke Harlow, who is Assistant Professor of History at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. Professor Harlow is a historian of the American Civil War era, and he has just written a highly engaging, and I would say also elegantly argued book called Religion, Race, and the Making of Confederate Kentucky, 1830 to 1880. The book has just appeared with Cambridge University Press in their series, Studies on the American South. Religion, Race, and the Making of Confederate Kentucky deals with the role of religion, and more specifically, evangelical Protestant Christianity and theology, in the struggle over slavery and abolition in the United States. The book makes an impressive case that we cannot really understand that struggle over slavery and abolition, or the war that grew out of that struggle, without fully appreciating the political, cultural, and intellectual history of conservative evangelical theology. And it is a book that, among many other things, reminded me of the absolute centrality of geography to the study of history, which is something that I think historians maybe sometimes we forget that a little bit, and I think it's an important point. Certainly something that I took away from reading this very, very engaging and highly interesting book. So on that note, let's get right to the discussion. Hi, Luke. How are you doing today?
Hi, Monica. Thanks for having me.
Very delighted to have you today and very delighted to have you talking about this very fascinating book. So maybe we'll get started by me asking you, please, to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself. Something about your background or your education, something you think might give people a fuller sense of this book and its importance to your work more generally.
Sure. Well, I came to this project in a variety of different kinds of ways, but as you mentioned, I am, among other things, a historian of the American Civil War era. This is primarily what I teach at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, and I've for a long time, I mean, going way back, probably even before I was a college student, was really interested, like a lot of Americans, I suppose, in the American Civil War, where it came from, what the causes of it were, what the results of it were, what the consequences of it were. And I found myself, I'm originally from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and in Bethlehem, there's a kind of inescapable sense of the local past. It's a town founded in the 1740s by Moravians. It's very close to Philadelphia, which has a lot of American history in it, of course, and it's not that far from Gettysburg. And so kind of growing up, I found myself in all these places. But I also have a lot of family from Kentucky and wound up going to Western Kentucky University for college. And it was there that I encountered some fantastic professors who were really good students of the history of the American South, really good sort of historians of American religion, and I guess you could say sort of lit a fire of intellectual passion or something like that. Maybe that's a little over the top, but that's
not
where,
at all.
That's where this kind of all had its origins. I was really interested in questions as a college student at Western Kentucky University, questions about the relationship between slavery, religion, the big questions in the American Civil War era, and sort of found my way to graduate school to explore those questions. And I guess you could say this book is, because it was originally a doctoral dissertation that I wrote at Rice University, was sort of the logical output of, you know, questions that have been formulating for well over a decade, for sure.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's really it's very interesting to hear people talk about their formative experiences, I think, and especially when someone comes to a project like this one that begins actually begins being formed early in a person's life. I always find that really interesting, and I'm sure other people do too. Let's talk a little bit more about the specifics of how you came, let's say, to the arguments of this book, or what. Let's hear a little bit about how the idea of this particular book gelled for you. When did you start having thoughts that you wanted to write about Kentucky, that you wanted to write about these particular sets of themes that you tackle in this book?
Yeah, I mean, despite my sort of undergraduate studies in Kentucky, I had very little interest in Kentucky as a subject of historical study. In fact, some of my undergraduate professors like to make a point when I see them that despite having courses called Kentucky History on the books, I refused to take them and never and never actually cared that much about it as an undergraduate, which is really my loss, because I went off to my first stop in graduate school was with a very distinguished historian of American religion named Mark Knoll, and I wrote a master's thesis under his direction at Wheaton College. And Mark at that time was working on a book. I was his research assistant. He was working on a book that was published in 2006 by the University of North Carolina Press called The Civil War is a Theological Crisis. And at that time, I was sort of trying to figure out where the struggle over slavery was happening in religious terms. Where were things really kind of hot and vibrant? And the story, that the kind of layman story that you have an anti-slavery North and a pro-slavery South, historians have done a lot to challenge that in all kinds of ways. But when it comes to religion, we know that, for example, the three biggest Protestant denominations in the United States, the Methodists, the Baptists, the Presbyterians, all split on the slavery question in the 1830s and 1840s. Mm-hmm. My own instinct was to sort of say, like, well, was there anyone in the South, was there anyone in slave-holding sort of states who challenged pro-slavery orthodoxy? Surely there were some people who thought this was problematic in one way or another. And so the genesis of this particular project was trying to answer that question. Where were there people who didn't agree that slavery was ordained by God, and for what reasons? And so I started thinking as a master's sort of thesis student about how to do that. And at the MA thesis level, it was a fairly workmanlike, it was a master's thesis. I'm, you know, whatever.
I think a lot of us know what that means.
Yeah, yeah. I had sort of three individuals who represented three different points on the kind of anti-slavery spectrum, one of which, all three of them are now in this book in very different form, but one of which was named John G. Fee. He's the founder of Berea College in Kentucky, which exists to this day. He's very much a radical evangelical abolitionist. One of which was named James M. Pendleton. He's a conservative, sort of Southern Baptist, anti-slavery voice who finds himself having to leave Kentucky during the Civil War, he's in Tennessee at that time, but he's fearing for his safety, finds himself in the North for almost the rest of his life. And then this kind of polemical, vociferous polemicist, let's say, Presbyterian by the name of Robert J. Breckinridge, who is also a kind of conservative anti-slavery individual of a variety, of a sort of another variety. And so the result was I wrote this master's thesis saying, well, here in this slave state are people who challenge slavery. They do it in ways that are complicated, that in the 21st century, we may not sort of agree with their racial politics. We may find that really discomforting. I mean, in fact, in the case of Pendleton and Breckinridge, their arguments are really whites first emancipationist arguments. That was sort of where it started. I had to sort of leave Kentucky as an undergraduate to see the usefulness of Kentucky as a place for historical inquiry. As I kind of continued the project forward, I realized that almost every position you can imagine on the pro or anti-slavery spectrum came to be articulated in Kentucky in one form or another. And so it kind of proved itself to be this really interesting historical laboratory where you see people kind of intellectually duking it out, in some cases physically, violently duking it out over the question of religion and slavery, all the way up through, as the book shows, the Reconstruction era.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's right. And the and so on that note, actually, I would ask you to, if you would come back to something that I mentioned at the outset when I was sort of just giving my little brief introduction to the main themes of your book. I mentioned that one of the things that was most striking for me, and I'm a non-specialist, I'll point that out for anyone who's listening, who might be interested. I'm not a specialist in the history of the United States, but one of the things that struck me most as a historian generally was the role of geography in this book, which I think for a variety of reasons that you illuminate here, you know, that you illuminate over the course of the book, is a really striking fact of what, you know, in other words, I guess what I'm trying to say is that what you were just describing about your master's thesis and finding a very great diversity of voices on the subject of slavery and abolition has a lot to do, I think, at least that's my reading of your book, with the fact of Kentucky. So I wonder if you could talk about that. Talk about Kentucky's role in this period of time from 1830 to 1880 in American history a little bit, and explain why Kentucky is such an important locus, a kind of key to your study.
Sure. Yeah. So Kentucky, one of the things to note right away about Kentucky in this period is that it has the longest of any free state slave state border, which is in the form of the Ohio River. The Ohio River separates Kentucky from Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois. It's 664 miles long of border. And Kentucky is a slave state, but right across the river are free states. And because the Ohio River is one of the most important, you know, transportation vehicles, really, transportation routes in this period, a lot of the kind of development of the sort of population centers of Kentucky are right on the river. Right across from Cincinnati in the north is Covington and Newport, Kentucky. Of course, Louisville, Kentucky's biggest city, right across from Indiana. And then you kind of go all the way down around to where the Ohio River lets out to the Mississippi. But that sort of long border makes it possible for there to be lots of contact with anti-slavery voices of a variety of kinds. And Cincinnati, for most of the period described in my book, is no hotbed of abolitionism. But Cincinnati is, you know, it is a free soil place. And they will have, by the 1850s, regular abolition conventions. They have abolitionist activity really throughout the period in this book. They have a sizable free black community, which is really important, a lot of whom are instrumental in aiding enslaved Kentuckians and their hopes for escape and so forth. And so you see, you know, at the near remove of Kentucky's border, lots of possibilities for what the end of slavery might mean. And I would say that for many conservatives within Kentucky's borders, they're frightened by this. Kentucky itself, because it is as far north as it is not what we think of in kind of traditional terms of, you know, the slaveholding South. It's not, you know, big cotton plantations or something like this. You can't really grow cotton in Kentucky. What they do have is a lot of tobacco, hemp, various other kinds, grains, this kind of thing. And according to the 1860 census, Kentucky is actually third among all states in slaveholders. Now, if they don't have, they do have some plantations, but largely what we're talking about is a dispersed middle class of slaveholders, using a kind of not totally efficient but useful definition of what it means to be sort of a, you know, larger larger slaveholder. You know, you might have five or something like that, five slaves. Kentucky has, most of its slaveholders have less than five slaves. 1860, about 20% of the Kentucky population is enslaved. So we're not talking about a huge slave population like you'd find in states deeper south that might have black majorities or something like this in certain parts of the state. But nonetheless, what we see is a widespread commitment to slaveholding in Kentucky, right across the river from free soil states. And so Kentucky is very much, as many historians have pointed out, a border state. I mean, that's kind of obvious. But what that border means is, as time goes on, it's constantly defining itself as the kind of bulwark that holds back the tide of the abolitionist North, or the increasingly anti-slavery North. Kentucky over time will come to define itself in more and more strident terms as you get sort of even beyond the war. So geography plays a really significant role in these kinds of things. Connected to free soil, connected to the Deep South, and it's sort of right there in the middle.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Well, thanks. It's great to have that laid out for us a little bit. Now let's get to the question of religion. I mean, one of the things that's very striking about this book is just, I mean, we assume, I suppose it in a certain way, it's almost commonsensical that this was a profoundly religious period in American history, but just how profoundly religious was something that struck me actually in reading the book. And you have people, lots of different kinds of people claiming religious motives for various sorts of political ideas, political approaches. And so maybe you can talk for a few minutes about the role that religion, and especially evangelical Protestantism, played in shaping the debates that became increasingly urgent, it seems, about slavery in the United States over the decades that you look at, especially in the early decades. But maybe you can start with those decades, and then we'll eventually in our conversation we'll get to the later periods too.
Sure. I mean, For 19th century American sort of cultural, political, intellectual historians, it's been well established by a long sort of historiography of how important religion is to just about everything in American history in the 19th century. The great sort of fantastic historian of religion in American politics in this period, Richard Carradine, has called evangelical Protestantism America's sort of most profound, most powerful subculture. Mm-hmm. And so the reason Carradine sort of justifies that claim is he says that, you know, just by a basic accounting that he does of denominations and actors and everything else, he estimates that something like 40% of all Americans were connected to evangelicalism in one way or another. One of the things that's very interesting about what Carradine shows there is that's sort of a national standard, and lots of historians have followed his lead. But when you go south of the Mason-Dixon line and the Ohio River, those numbers get even more enhanced. And so in Kentucky, in the place I study, those numbers are more like 60 to 70% of the population is connected to evangelicalism in one way or another. Now, that's a hard number to get at. We don't really have good ways of doing it, partially because it's very hard to become a member of a church at this time. Mm-hmm. But lots of people are going to church, and lots of people are connected to church. And undeniably, churches are the most prominent voluntary organizations in American history at this time. I mean, these are the great kind of associations in that way. In the place I study in Kentucky, even using the most restrictive numbers available, which would be membership numbers, by the time you get to the end of my book, something like one out of every 10 Kentuckians is formally the member of a Baptist church. Hmm. The Methodists have also pretty significant rates of adherence, and so do the Presbyterian. And that's like formal, you know, people sign their name, join, are there regularly. There's all kinds of other people who are attending. So one of the things that that's really significant about religion in this period is it's making claims on people's lives. It's sort of asking people to have a series of values that they assent to. And so one of the things that I thought was really important to get at was, what are those values? What is it that these sort of individuals, these churches, ministers, my sources come from all kinds of different things, but a lot of some of my best sources are in formal denominational records, newspapers, these kinds of things, where they're saying very clearly, this is the way we think the Christian God has called human societies to order themselves, to construct themselves, to live in the world. Mm-hmm. And this is what it looks like to be a good Christian. And for most of the white denominations, what they're saying is, to be a good Christian, you don't have to hold slaves. But to be a good Christian, you can't say that slaveholding is wrong because it's ordained by God in the Bible. And it's all over the Old Testament, particularly in the Mosaic Code. In the New Testament, the writings of the Apostle Paul seem to offer a different reading maybe on what slavery should be, but nonetheless a positive sanction for slavery. And the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth in the Gospels seem to never challenge slavery. And they're very happy to point out that Jesus will condemn adultery. Jesus will condemn divorce. Jesus doesn't say a word about slaveholding. And he, of course, is living in a slaveholding time and society himself. And so this is sort of the way that, you know, religion relates to the slavery question in Kentucky in the period.
Yeah. Then maybe next you could tell us a little bit about the major positions, because there are a variety of different positions that people hold on the question that that evangelical people hold on the question of slavery. And I mean, the three sort of main positions that you outline in the book are abolitionist, gradual emancipationist, and pro-slavery positions. And I wonder if you could explain what the people espousing each of these positions actually held, you know, what their biblical sanction was as they saw it, and what role theology played in the shaping of each of those important positions.
Sure, yeah. So the pro-slavery and gradual emancipationist positions are both conservative in their approach to the Bible. They employ a very similar hermeneutic, a similar, in other words, method of interpretation of the text, which is very commonsensical. It's very straightforward. It's very informed by sort of the Scottish Enlightenment in terms of its approach to the text. And their reading of that text emphasizes that the text can be read plainly, literally, can be understood by anybody who picks it up. And when you read the Bible that way, you see lots of slavery in it, as I was explaining a minute ago, and you say, slavery's all over the place, and I don't see a lot of language in here that sort of, you know, condemns slavery in any way. I mean, there'll be one of the famous sort of texts that people think challenges slavery is in the writings of Paul, Galatians chapter 3, verse 28. In Christ, there is no Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female, and so on and so on. Mm-hmm. Well, pro-slavery individuals, they look at that and they say, right, in Christ. But in the world, there are all these other distinctions. So it's okay to have, you know, enslaved peoples be members of your churches. You would want that. You want to have a kind of missions to the slaves because sort of God has called for that. In this sort of theological reading, gradual emancipationists would say, you know, we look around the world, we look around, or at least, you know, the American context, and we see a lot of slavery, and we don't like it. It's clearly abusive. It clearly destroys family ties. The Bible kind of has an idea of slavery, particularly in the Mosaic Code, that, you know, slaves are to be set free in the Jubilee every 7 years. Mm-hmm. Debts are to be forgiven. That doesn't happen in America. You're not supposed to separate families because family is also a God-given institution. Well, that doesn't happen in America. I mean, the slave trade is profound. I mean, by the time you get to the late antebellum period in places like Virginia, 1 in 3, you know, slaves is being sold off. So this is, you know, this is a profound destroyer of families. In the biblical accounts, it looks like, you know, slavery encourages slaves to be members of communities. In one of the famous sort of Pauline letters, the letter to Philemon, Paul sort of instructs this enslaved man, Onesimus, to return to his condition of bondage. He's a sort of fugitive slave. He's instructed to return to his condition of bondage, but Paul is also instructing Philemon to sort of accept him as an equal in the community and all these other kinds of things. Gradual emancipationists say, we can't really get around the text, the biblical text. We can't really argue that slavery is not ordained by God. Clearly, slavery is ordained by God. But perhaps American slavery is not ordained by God. Perhaps what we have on the ground here is really problematic. And we need to find some way of working around that. What that means is that pro-slavery and gradual emancipationist believers believe essentially the same things about the Bible, but their application of what the Bible says is going to be different. The third position, abolitionists, they go completely in a different direction. And they say, you know, all those things that the gradual emancipationists say about, you know, slavery on the ground in America, right. And look, there's nobody in their right mind, abolitionists will say, that thinks slavery in any way could possibly be just, could possibly be humane. And they especially, there are all kinds of, you know, different perspectives on the abolitionist spectrum, everything from a kind of radical skepticism about the Bible, which would be espoused by someone like William Lloyd Garrison, a very famous abolitionist from Boston, to a much more kind of, you know, respectful position about the Bible. Certainly John G. Fee, who appears in my book, espouses this. But they're going to come at it from a very different kind of hermeneutical approach than either pro-slavery or gradual emancipationists. In fact, African-American abolitionists inside and outside Kentucky, abolitionists elsewhere, you know, many of whom are very proud to call themselves sort of evangelicals, will say, that may be what the Bible says, but we need a different reading. We need a different teaching. We need to interpret this text in a very different kind of way because, you know, a straightforward reading of the Bible is giving us a society that is profoundly unjust. And so you get kind of this collision of these three different positions that all kind of come together in this mid-19th century period.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really, really just fascinating. And speaking of collisions, I wanted to ask you next about in the second chapter of your book, I think it's called Heresy and Schism, if I'm remembering correctly, you discuss the years between 1836 and 1845 when, and I remember this from my undergraduate days and I was very proud of myself, when a series of schisms over slavery and abolition, precisely what you've been discussing, divided at a national level Presbyterians, Baptists, and Methodists, these three very prominent evangelical denominations. And Kentucky, of course, as you point out many times in your book, was home to a great many gradualist emancipationists. I guess maybe I'm using incorrect terminology, and you can certainly feel free to correct
me. No, that's correct.
Is that right? Okay. But in that chapter two, you argue that gradualism, I mean, it sounds better than pro-slavery, right, on its face, or gradualist theology was pro-slavery theology. And I wonder if you could tell us what that means exactly and what kinds of evidence you marshal to make that claim.
Sure, yeah. I mean, the basic point there is that when it comes to their view of the Bible, when it comes to the way they think about truth, Christian truth in the world, gradual emancipationists, despite not liking American slavery, essentially agree with the pro-slavery approach to the Bible. They agree with the kind of commonsensical literalist hermeneutic that the pro-slavery theologians will invoke. What's interesting about that is that these are people who, for purposes of politics, really try to do things that will end slavery. Now, they're going to try and end slavery gradually. They're going to try and end slavery slowly. But they are not insincere in their anti-slavery activism. And so, you know, they find themselves in the 1830s and 40s in the midst of some seriously tumultuous moments in national kind of Christian discussion over the slavery question. In 1837, the Presbyterians split into New School and Old School factions. Here, slavery is really a secondary concern. Here, the split is not entirely sectional, which is to say it's not just along the Ohio River and Mason-Dixon line. It's not just you get Southern New School Presbyterians. You have plenty of Northern Old School Presbyterians. Their flagship seminary is Princeton Theological Seminary, arguably one of the two or three most influential seminaries in the long 19th century in American history. But slavery is a secondary calculation, a secondary concern. And Kentuckians are very influential in the denomination, and in this split. And when they're talking, they're saying, you know, when this split happened, this split between old school and new school, yeah, a lot of theological questions were in play that were very important. But those theological questions that were in play, if you're not conservative, you might wind up an abolitionist. And we're not interested in having fellowship with those people. Mm. Well, in the 1840s, the Methodist and Baptist have very serious schisms that have been building for several years that are, these, unlike the Presbyterians, are clearly sectional. In 1844 and 1845, in the Methodist Episcopal Church, which had been the largest religious denomination in the country, some 1.1 million members, the Baptists are more complicated because they don't have a formal denominational structure. They come together for the purposes of raising money for missions, and their churches are autonomous, sort of independent churches amongst themselves. These two denominations, the Methodist Episcopal Church and the American Baptist Home Mission Society, will fracture because slavery will be introduced as a subject in their sort of conventions that meet every several years. In both of these schisms, particularly in the case of the Methodist schism happens, and there's an individual by the name of Henry B. Bascom. Bascom is the president of Transylvania University in Lexington, Kentucky. Bascom's had a very illustrious career. He was the chaplain to the U.S. House of Representatives formerly, because Henry Clay really liked him. He had been an agent of the American Colonization Society, which is a gradual emancipationist organization that wants to end slavery by deporting the entire population of African Americans. They don't get very far with this, but nonetheless, they for Bascom and many others, they think this is a way to end slavery in America. Bascom remains an emancipationist after 1845. But in 1844, Southern Methodists get very hacked off at Northern Methodists. And they get hacked off over a dispute over whether or not a bishop can be a slaveholder. And this has been raised because a Georgia bishop by the name of James O. Andrew had become a slaveholder. And he's sort of Northern Methodists want to censure this position. Bascom, the gradual emancipationist, for reasons of theology, writes the minority protest and then writes a document in 1845 called Methodism and Slavery that argues that Northern Methodists, because of their anti-slavery position, have deviated from traditional Christian orthodoxy and that it would be right to create a Southern church. There are many such individuals who do similar things. Bascom's probably the most prominent of them. But the long and the short of it is they're arguing here in these splits, you know, many of us may not like American slavery as it exists. Many of us are gradual emancipationists, but for purposes of theology, we're very much aligned with the South. And Kentuckians are right at the center of that whole thing. They're right at the center of helping to create, these denominations. And so, back to sort of where we started with this conversation, they're defining what that border, what that boundary means. Like here, religiously, the slavery question is going to take on a very different register than it's going to take north of the Ohio River.
Yeah, right. So, well, tell us this then. Let's talk about politics. If the gradual emancipationist folks and the pro-slavery folks were so similar, or even, you know, in some ways inseparable, in a religious from a religious point of view, what do their politics look like?
Yeah, this is a great question. I mean, if they're so alike theologically, what else is there to say?
Right.
Why don't they just sort of all become pro-slavery and next thing you know, they're wearing a Confederate gray? Well, the reality is that that gradual emancipationists have a very different view of what should happen politically around the slavery question. And here again, Kentucky becomes a very central place. It's one of the latest places to debate having emancipation as a kind of legal fact in the United States. In the North, gradual emancipation begins in the era of the American Revolution. Almost every northern state, including the old Northwest territories, which become Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, eventually Michigan, Wisconsin. There's slavery throughout the North in the era of the American Revolution. But in the wake of the American Revolution, states develop laws that will slowly, gradually free the slaves that are in their midst so that slavery will die a very slow death. And this is the kind of dominant normative way you end slavery in America up to the Civil War. This is what most people think, most whites anyway, think that the way to end slavery is. You do this gradually, you do it slow, you do it by law, by constitutional amendment. And Virginia entertains a debate like this in the early 1830s. Kentucky debates it in 1849. And emancipationists in Kentucky, many of whom are the state's most prominent ministers, put together an emancipation party. There's a canvass that starts taking place in 1847, 1848. And in 1849, there's going to be a convention where they draw up a constitution.
Right. That's right.
And this is going to be, you know, sort of the emancipationist moment to prove that Kentucky can gradually emancipate, that Kentucky is not like the Deep South. Henry Clay is behind this. Robert J. Breckinridge is behind this. He becomes the kind of chair of the Emancipation Party. The long and the short of it is this position is seen as anathema to pro-slavery individuals. Pro-slavery individuals in the Deep South, of course, but also in Kentucky. And when the chips are down and the voters go to the polls, they elect a slate that is almost entirely pro-slavery, maybe 10, maybe 12, maybe 13 or 14% go for emancipation. That's it. This is significant in the history of the American South. I mean, not a lot of other states could claim emancipation adherence that high.
Yeah.
But that's not very high. I mean, 10% is not a workable polity in any stretch of the imagination. 2 years later, the emancipationists try again in 1851 and get something like 3% of the vote. It's wow. And there it's not about constitution revision. The constitution that comes in 1850 strengthens the rights of slaveholders, has no provisions for emancipation, looks like lots of other kind of Deep South state constitutions you would have, and essentially ensures slavery's viability into the future. So where people had been aligned on theology, these gradualists and pro-slavery believers, they are completely at odds when it comes to politics. And, you know, really famous Southern politicians of this time period, like John C. Calhoun and James Henry Hammond from South Carolina, are both looking at the situation in Kentucky and looking at the gradual emancipationists and saying, you know, sure, they say they're with us when it comes to this theological question about the righteousness of slavery, but their politics show us something else. Their politics show us that they're not to be trusted, that they're not really part of what we're trying to do down here with, you know, kind of slavery in the South.
Yeah, very interesting. So, okay, so you've given us a sense of the sort of the unity amongst various conservative Protestants in theological terms, and then you've given us a sense of how divided these folks were at the very same time in terms of their politics. But what you show over the course of the book is that that too changes. In other words, the division between these two groups is not sustained. So what comes finally or what I mean, it's kind of a stupid question in a way, but what is the thing that comes to unify gradual emancipationists with pro-slavery believers?
Yeah, I mean, that thing is in the one hand, the Civil War.
Right.
But it's not the Civil War itself. It's what comes as part of the Civil War. It's emancipation.
Yes.
The Civil War. So the Civil War comes, and as I think probably a lot of people know, Kentucky stays in the Union, and that's a contested thing. There are a minority of Confederate sympathizers. They attempt to form a Confederate government in Russellville, Kentucky. But the long and the short of it is that most white Kentuckians seem to be on board with the Union. Overwhelmingly, black Kentuckians are definitely on board with the Union.
Yes.
Because the Union means liberation. Now, there's a lot of really important research that I draw upon that talks about what that process of emancipation looked like. I mean, one of the great things that's gone on in sort of Civil War era studies in the last generation or so is to show that emancipation is a process, not an event. And it's a process that takes place with enslaved peoples themselves rising up and sort of fleeing to Union Army camps, looking for sort of protection.
Right.
And so in Kentucky, one of the biggest of these camps is in central Kentucky, Jessamine County. It's in Camp Nelson, which is not too far today from Lexington and Richmond and where Berea College ultimately is. But it's in the sort of center part of the state. Some 13,000 enslaved peoples will find freedom there over the course of the war. This is no sort of bed of roses path to freedom. I mean, there are cases of very significant cases of enslaved peoples sort of being left out in the cold and freezing to death, dying of exposure, disease. I mean, all kinds of nasty things are happening. But the long and the short of it is they're not acting as slaves. And that's really the critical piece for this question about what unites pro-slavery theological conservatives with gradualists, gradual emancipationists. In the course of the war, Kentucky will end up sending nearly 24,000 men to fight for the Union, African-American men to fight for the Union. This number is more than 10% of all blacks who serve in the Union Army and Navy.
Wow.
But what's most staggering about it is that it is 57% of all military-age black men in Kentucky. And that 57% dwarfs the African-American contribution from any other state. And the key reason why you see over 50% of military-age men signing up for the Union in Kentucky is because it is the only path to freedom in Kentucky.
Yes.
Kentucky is a Union slave state, which means that when the Emancipation Proclamation comes down, it does not apply. It means that when Abraham Lincoln signs orders allowing for the recruitment of black troops, Kentucky's going to be exempted initially because Unionist slaveholders are sort of politically putting the screws to Lincoln and saying, hey, remember us? We're loyal here. We're not part of this rebellion, which is how Lincoln always thinks of the Civil War or thinks of the Confederate cause. And, you know, we here are the loyal slaveholders of Kentucky, and we're not part of this. Well, in 1864, Kentucky fails to meet its quota of sort of required troops for the Union war effort. And Lincoln says, look, you have a mass amount of sort of manpower in the form of your African-American population, and we're going to start enlisting African-Americans. What all this means is that this whole kind of argument about God's design, gradual emancipation, God's design for slavery, gradual emancipation must come slowly with black removal, all these kinds of things. All of a sudden you have this civil war where to fight that civil war on the cause of the Union, enslaved peoples or formerly enslaved peoples are marching the Union line saying, I will take a gun and I will enlist to fight for the Union cause in a war to overthrow slavery. I mean, this becomes all too much. I mean, this is where, you know, pro-slavery and gradualists just sort of come back together. And you know, the long and the short of it is just say, this isn't what we had in mind. I mean, whatever we had in mind about American slavery and its gradual end, this is not it. And as much as sort of we know that emancipation was a process, not an event. The reality is it comes through cataclysm. It comes through upheaval. It comes through civil war. And gradual emancipationists, by and large, are not willing to go there. And they are not willing to accept the emancipationist consequence of the Civil War.
Yeah, that is just fascinating. And once again, it seems like it makes Kentucky's history seem so particularly fascinating in this era because it just doesn't fit any of the. I mean, now again, I'm speaking as someone who's much less steeped in these issues than you are, obviously, but it doesn't fit into the what I sort of assumed happened, which was that Reconstruction somehow also took place in Kentucky, but it doesn't. Reconstruction doesn't take place in Kentucky. And on that note, I'll ask you this next question, just to kind of follow up on that thought. Kentucky, in a sense, I mean, this is, to me, I have to say for myself, the one of the most fascinating aspects of the book comes later after you've kind of warmed us up with all of these fascinating topics that we've been discussing so far. And you've taken us through the various arguments about religion, about theology, about politics, about the war, about emancipation and its effects, its particular effects in Kentucky, and the particular way in which it unfolded in Kentucky. And then this is the real, this is what really sealed it for me. Kentucky, in a sense, becomes Confederate, you argue, after the fact. You say that without serving the Confederacy, I'm quoting from the book now, without serving the Confederacy, Kentucky joined the redemption. And you also write that the Civil War destroyed slavery, but it did not destroy the faith that sustained slavery. And those are kind of linked quotes in my mind. So I wonder if you could explain what you mean by that and explain to us how Reconstruction doesn't take place in Kentucky and what happens instead.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, Kentucky, so because Kentucky's Unionist, Kentucky is really never forced to do any of the things that the states of the Confederacy are forced to do to rejoin the Union. Part of that includes, I should back up and say Reconstruction is attempted in Kentucky. I mean, there is an attempt to do something like what we think of as Reconstruction, which is to say the Freedmen's Bureau, who is tasked with the redistribution of abandoned lands, which is tasked with adjudicating over, you know, contract disputes between freed people and landowners, it's often black-white relations there. It's tasked with, you know, medical care and broad relief, sometimes involved with education. The Freedmen's Bureau is operating in Kentucky. Now, white Kentuckians, they're very upset about this. I mean, they're basically saying, we have no reason. I mean, white Southerners more generally kind of don't like the Freedmen's Bureau because it's seen by many of them as a kind of political arm of emancipationist republicanism, or military arm, I should say, of a political position. Mm. But in Kentucky, it's sort of there. But when it comes to the politics, Kentucky is not forced to enfranchise African Americans. Kentucky is not forced to disfranchise Confederate sympathizers. Mm-hmm. Kentucky is not forced to do all kinds of political things that would change the political landscape of Kentucky. So very quickly, there is a disfranchisement bill that for Confederates that the state legislature had passed at the start of the Civil War. Basically, right after the war in late 1865, early 1866, the legislature takes that off the books, and immediately a whole slate of ex-Confederates get elected as part of what becomes a white, basically an all-white Democratic Party. Because African Americans are not enfranchised in Kentucky, there is no kind of base for a Republican Party to operate like you would see in other places, Mississippi, South Carolina, this sort of thing. And so the kind of politics of Reconstruction that we tend to think of don't happen in Kentucky. And Kentucky becomes basically, without having fought for the Confederacy, the most unreconstructed state, because starting in late 1865, they immediately start doing what we associate with a later period in Reconstruction, what we call redemption. Where they basically restore white home rule, so-called, where they do all kinds of things to make it really hard for freed people to operate in society. There's all kinds of cases, the Freedmen's Bureau reports, of violence against African Americans and whites who sympathize with them. And the long and the short of it is that, I mean, as soon as the war is over, Kentucky finds itself doing things that the ex-Confederate South will be doing, but before. That happens elsewhere. The 14th Amendment, which historians love to show how complicated it is, but the long and the short of it, where the 14th Amendment sort of gives rise to multiracial birthright citizenship, the 15th Amendment allows for the enfranchisement of men regardless of race in the United States. One of the ironies of the 15th Amendment when it comes down is that almost every former slave state has a state constitution that has that provision, that has African-American male suffrage. And it's the northern states that don't have it. Well, Kentucky is like the last. Kentucky doesn't even ratify any of these amendments. They shoot them all down. And so when they're forced to accept them by law, of course, they sort of begrudgingly do. But they don't vote for them. And, you know, the state becomes completely under the sway of a white Democratic Party. And it continues that way really for the next generation plus. I mean, it takes a very long time for you to see cracks in that foundation.
Yeah, very fascinating. I have to say, it's just it's a really good read. It's a beautifully written book, and I encourage lots of people to go and read it. I feel like we're impinging a bit on your time at this point, and maybe we need to start just to wrap things up. We've taken up a lot of your time, and you've been very generous with us, Luke. And I wonder if you just mind answering one final question, which is basically, everyone will be interested to know what you're working on now.
Sure.
Can you tell us?
Yeah. No, of course. So one of the things that the book shows where it ends, that where religion, race, and the making of Confederate Kentucky ends, is it ends with all these sort of white Southern denominations arguing into the 1870s and 80s that God has ordained slavery, that slavery was right, and that's why, going back to the 1830s and 40s, we will not reunite. This is why we will not have fellowship with Northern abolitionist heretics for Christian purposes.
Right.
And you know, that's a nice place to end a monograph, because monographs need to end and not become life works. but really what I want to do is run that out in the next project. I'm kicking around a book called The Pro-Slavery Origins of American Fundamentalism. And it sort of argues that once you have the death of American slavery, that what remained unchallenged was the theology, as you quoted a minute ago, the theology that gave life to the defense of slavery. And that theology is never really, it never really goes away. It hangs around. It comes on in kind of new form. And not necessarily around the slavery question per se, but that the residue of the debates over slavery give life to debates that will be seen in the next generation over what gets called fundamentalism and modernism, and sort of the debates between more conservative Protestants and Protestant liberals. So that different from the way we tend to think of American religious history, where in the 19th century, there's this debate that leads to fundamentalism and modernism, and the debate hinges on questions about Darwin's theories about human origins, or where the debate turns on new innovations coming out of Germany dealing with, higher criticism of the biblical text and, who wrote the biblical text.
Right.
Questions over immigration and the challenge that happens to Protestant hegemony in the United States, because in the late 19th century, we see, immigrants from all over the place who are bringing particularly Judaism and Catholicism in sort of rising numbers to the United States scenes. And America becomes this place that's, Protestant, Catholic, Jew, as we kind of talk about it in the early 20th century. What I want to say is, like, not that all of those things are wrong, but that we should think very seriously about the role of the theological debate over slavery and what happens coming out of the Civil War, so that the Civil War is very much at the center of American religious history. And so I think sort of one way to get at that is to think more about what the long life of pro-slavery religion means and what it did.
Really interesting. I think a lot of people will be interested to read that book, Luke. So I think maybe we should let you go now. And it's been a deep pleasure. It really has. The author's name is Luke E. Harlow. He is assistant professor of history at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. His book is called Religion, Race, and the Making of Confederate Kentucky, 1830 to 1880. It has just appeared with Cambridge University Press. I urge you to read it. And Luke, thanks so much for your time. We have really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.